The night sky in focus and the latest news from space. This is The Sky Tonight with Pete Singleton and Cambridge astronomers Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough. Only on HCR 104 FM.
You're listening to The Sky Tonight, looking towards the stars each month on HCR 104 FM.
Hello again and welcome to The Sky Tonight, HCR 104 FM's monthly astronomy show, looking at the stars and discussing the latest events in space. I'm Pete Singleton. I'm joined by Paul Fellows, Chairman of the Cambridge Astronomical Association, and Jonathan Clough, also of that association, and both Fellows of the Royal Astronomical Society. On this edition, we're going to be looking at plans for a NASA probe to be sent into interstellar space. Maybe it'll get even further than Voyager. There's been a flare on Proxima Centauri. There's a double quasar being spotted. China's been launching a part of a space station, the initial part of a space station, and also plans a Hubble-type space telescope. We look at NASA. We've had a return of the first crew that SpaceX launched to the space station. And also we will look at the life of Michael Collins, the forgotten man of Apollo 11. I say forgotten, not really forgotten, because he was a very important part of that mission, obviously. And Ingenuity, the little helicopter that's flying around on Mars. So, shall we start with that, gentlemen? And first of all, let me welcome Paul and Jonathan. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Pete.
And let's start then with, shall we look at the NASA probe, first of all? Paul, what can you tell us about this?
Well, this is a very interesting proposal that's got to the stage four of its acceptance through to becoming a real mission now with NASA. The idea comes out of the advanced physics lab at Johns Hopkins University, and it is to launch a probe probably in about 8 years' time, in 2030 or thereabouts, and send it way out beyond into interstellar space in order to be able to explore the outer reaches of the sun's influence, the heliopause, the extent of the solar wind and so on, but also perhaps get to the inner edge of the Oort cloud, which is still undiscovered but believed to be the source of a lot of the icy bodies that fall into the solar system and give us the long period comets. And a very interesting aspect to this is that the first direction they plan to set off in to go to the outer solar system is straight in towards the sun.
Right.
They want to fly past the sun at a range of just 1 million miles and do a slingshot past it to use the sun's gravity to hurl themselves out of the solar system and pick up a lot of speed that way. Usually we do that by flying things past other planets. But going as close to the sun as that is going to heat the spacecraft to about 2,500 degrees.
Gosh, well, that's about a million miles fly past it, you say?
million miles. That's fairly toasty, really.
It is fairly close.
Yeah. And to solve it, they plan to use a heat shield, which has little channels in it through which they'll pass cooling hydrogen. And the hydrogen gas will get heated up inside the cooling tubes. And then they're going to shoot it out the back to add thrust. And so effectively, this hydrogen fuel is going to be heated by solar energy. And so it's a two birds with one stone. It provides the cooling for the spacecraft, but also gives it propulsion without actually having to carry any burnable fuel. So gives it a lot more thrust per unit weight. And it's because of that that they think they'll be able to get outside the solar system in just 15 years.
Right, okay.
And the goal is to reach a distance from the sun of 50 billion miles, which, to put it into context, is 10 times further away than the Voyager probes have reached, despite the fact they set off in 1970. Or another way of saying it, it's 500 astronomical units. The Earth-Sun distance is an astronomical unit. Neptune is about 30 astronomical units, and they want to go to 500. And one of the reasons that that is very interesting from an astronomer's point of view is that with it, we can use observations from the probe along with those from Earth to give us a baseline 500 astronomical units long for doing triangulation, parallax measurements of the distance to distant stars. So we'll be able to reach much more accurately measure the nearby stars and their positions and reach further out as well. And this is similar to a proposal from Johns Hopkins that's been around for a while for the TAU project, the 1,000 astronomical unit probe, which was going to be nuclear electric and ion drive. But this other one is going to be much cheaper and quicker to get built and launched. So it might actually get done and be very interesting to see if it can reach the inner edge of the Oort cloud.
Mm. Do we know when NASA will plan to launch the probe?
Yeah, if it gets accepted, it'll be launched in 2030, so in just 8 years' time.
Okay.
And most of that time will be the engineering of the spacecraft.
Yeah. Oh, well, that sounds very interesting. We'll have to keep an eye on that then. Let's go to our next topic. And Ingenuity, the little drone or helicopter, as it's been called. Jonathan, this has been amazing pictures from the surface of the Red Planet, of this little thing taking off. I know it's separate pictures all put together to show the continuous motion, but it's really amazing.
It is quite amazing. I suppose you could say it has its ups and downs, being a helicopter. I mean, there actually is true video comeback as well. There's been video taken by the Mars rover, the Perseverance rover, and that's shown the flight of the Ingenuity helicopter. And it's now done four flights. The fourth flight was slightly delayed because they had a software problem, and they're now pondering whether to actually go back to an earlier version of the software for future operations. However, the fourth flight did happen, and it was the longest so far. It was a 266-metre round trip, which doesn't sound particularly exciting, but it's, you know, by far the furthest it's gone so far. And it flew for 1 minute 57 seconds, and given its flight duration is calculated to be a maximum of 2 minutes, that's pretty good. And they're so pleased with the results that it actually achieved all of its mission objectives in the first three flights anyway, which was basically to prove you could fly a helicopter on Mars.
Not particularly scientific, was it?
Yeah, so it's now actually going to become more of an operational phase where it will work in tandem with the Perseverance rover, which is sort of what you'd expect to happen anyway. It can act as a scout and go out ahead of Perseverance, and it can go to places Perseverance won't be able to go and take photographs. They're also going to use it to try to do a survey of the elevation, digital elevation maps, they call it, to get a better understanding of the terrain. So it will start to work in tandem. I mean, it's independent of Perseverance, so it has to stop and recharge its batteries after every flight. And as I say, it only has a 2-minute flight duration. And they're planning to fly it about every 2 weeks, as I understand it. I don't think it takes 2 weeks to recharge its batteries, but maybe that's to be doubly sure it's got full power. But Flight 5, which should happen fairly soon, will be a one-way trip because it's going to move to a new airfield. It's going to transition to somewhere in the direction they want to take Perseverance, land there, and then it'll be able to do some recce's out ahead of Perseverance, which sounds great fun.
I think the main thing, isn't it, Paul, that they've proved that it actually can be done.
I think so, yes. It's amazing to think that they've managed to make this thing take off in the very thin atmosphere. I know, obviously, they'd worked it all out beforehand and tested it, and they've got only a third of Earth's gravity to contend with, but it flies very well, doesn't it? So quite amazing. I did read about the software glitch that caused them to delay the fourth takeoff. But basically, the system got stuck in a pre-flight check mode and wouldn't actually command itself to take off. So they uploaded new software to it, and that fixed it, but it's only fixed it 85% of the time. There's still a 15% chance that when you tell it to fly, it'll just sit there. So they're still pondering just what to do, whether to just live with that and have the odd time where it needs to be recycled and rebooted, or try and find some way of fixing it.
Yeah, indeed. And Perseverance itself is still performing well, isn't it?
Yes, doing a good job, really. It's a complicated process because you can't have a human in the loop to drive these machines, and they have to be able to autonomously find their way around all the boulders and other obstructions and not get stuck, which quite difficult in the terrain. It seems very, very rocky where they've landed.
And of course, one of the plans is to retrieve some samples on a future mission that Perseverance has selected from the surface of Mars. Is that right, Jonathan?
Yeah, that's right. The idea is it will take samples and it will parcel them up into a capsule, which they'll leave for collection by a subsequent mission. And that could well be a European mission where you'll have another rover going along picking things up. But that rover will be equipped with a small rocket system to fire these samples back into orbit to be collected then by an orbiter, which is set up to then return them to Earth. So it's a very ambitious mission for the future. So it'll be some years before we get any samples back, but that is the plan.
Good. Shall we just briefly mention that the first official crew on the SpaceX Dragon has returned from the International Space Station with a successful splashdown. I think it was on Saturday morning, our time. I don't know whether you guys watched it on being streamed.
I did see it being streamed. It was a nighttime landing. It was really exciting.
I was struck by the comparison with the Soyuz bump downs, or whatever you want to call them, as opposed to splashdowns, and how the SpaceX guys seem to be so... Everyone has their own job, and it just seems to go so well. And it seemed to be such in contrast with the Soyuz landings that we see, where they get bundled out onto those chairs and these guys are all milling around them, and I don't know, it just seems so smooth. And
it's a bit more like a sort of Formula One pit stop, isn't it, with the tyres?
Well, it was a great success, really, because Americans back into space from American soil and landed safely as well. And of course, it's a first for SpaceX, really. Although there has been the test mission before this one, but this was the first official mission. Shall we move then on, gentlemen, to I think, Paul, you want to talk about Proxima Centauri, and there's been a flare seen.
Yes, so Proxima Centauri is the nearest star to the Sun, just 4.2 light years away, and it's a little red dwarf star, quite a small star, almost the smallest star that can be a proper star. And it has two known planets, potentially more. So Proxima B is around about the same size as the Earth, maybe a little bit bigger, so 1 to 2 Earth masses. But it orbits around Proxima very, very closely, just 0.04 of an astronomical unit, much more closely to its star than Mercury is to the Sun. And then Proxima C is a larger planet, about 7 times the mass of the Earth, and orbits roughly at the same distance that Mars does, at 1.5 astronomical units. And with the lower temperature of the star, it's a cool red dwarf star, the amount of heat coming away means that of those two planets, B, the nearer one, is probably just about at the right temperature for water to exist, so around about 0 degrees centigrade. But the further out one is much colder, at minus 230 or something, so about the same sort of chilly temperature as Neptune. And we think of that as the sort of, oh, well, that might mean that Proxima B could be a habitable planet. But these little red dwarf stars can be quite vicious, and we knew that they produced these rather large solar flares, and Proxima was caught just recently producing one that was 100 times more powerful than the most powerful one recorded on the Sun ever. And it was caught by both the Hubble Space Telescope and the ALMA radio telescope array. And the Hubble was observing it in ultraviolet light and saw that the levels of UV went up to 14,000 times their normal level. So I think that doesn't bode well for the idea of life on Proxima B, because 14,000 times the amount of ultraviolet is going to do any life there no good at all, unless it's hiding underground or something. It would certainly destroy any ozone layer or anything like that in the atmosphere in a matter of seconds. So it just goes to show that you can't necessarily trust these little red dwarf stars to behave themselves. And the shame about that is that there's 70% of the stars in the universe are little red dwarfs. So it rather points to the possibilities for habitable planets needing to be around other types of less common stars. And we've always suspected that these stars were active with these flares, but this is the first time that such a powerful one has been caught in action.
Okay. Gents, we have to take a break very shortly. So we've got a topic on this double quasar that's been spotted, but perhaps we can talk that in the deep sky part of our night sky discussions later in the show, if I may.
Coming to you live from our corner of the universe, this is The Sky Tonight on HCR 104 FM. On HCR 104 FM.
Welcome back to The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM. I'm Pete Singleton, and I'm joined, as always, by Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough of the Cambridge Astronomical Association. If any listeners out there want to ask us any questions about anything to do with astronomy or the current space news, and then why not drop us an email at skytonight, all one word, skytonight at hcrfm.co.uk. Skytonight at hcrfm.co.uk, and we'll include any questions or and answers to those questions in next month's show. I want to now move on to a couple of Chinese stories. Perhaps, Jonathan, you can kick us off on this. There's a Chinese sort of Hubble Space Telescope, but it won't be called that. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, it's very similar to the Hubble Space Telescope. It's called the Chinese Space Station Telescope, CSST. And I'm sorry, I don't know too much about it, but the Chinese name for it is Zunqian, which translates as the survey the heavens.
Okay.
It's a similar size to the Hubble Space Telescope. It's got a 6.6 foot or 2 meter lens, which is very similar to the Hubble scope mirror, but it's got a much a broader field of view, so it won't be quite as tight a view. So the idea is it can actually get a bigger picture, but at the same sort of definition. And it will be launched to run alongside the Chinese space station, which is going to be has already had its first section launched, and actually that was only last week where the first module was put in space.
Will that be higher than the ISS at a greater distance from the Earth, or
I don't absolutely know the height. I'd imagine it would be a very similar orbit. I don't know for sure. One thing which is a bit different than the current relationship between the ISS and the Hubble Space Telescope is that the intention is the Chinese Hubble will actually orbit in a similar orbit to the space station, okay, which will allow it to be serviced by the space station, which was never part of the Hubble plan. As you remember, Hubble was serviced by the shuttle.
Shuttle, yeah.
So the idea is that the Chinese telescope can be refueled by docking with the space station from time to time, and if it needs any repairs, that would be done in the same way. So it's an interesting variation in the approach.
Mm. All right, it will be as the Chinese space station won't be as big as the international one, will it?
No, it's a smaller venture, but it's still going to involve a number of different modules. The one which went up this week was the accommodation module, and it's designed to accommodate up to 3 astronauts at a time. So that gives you an idea of the scale.
Right.
Whereas the Hubble, sorry, not the Hubble, the International Space Station, I think has had up to 7 at one time, and of course has the Russian module and the US module. So you have those 2 separate areas. This will be a Chinese venture. But it will have a number of different modules going up to join the accommodation module to allow experimentation to be done and for different vehicles to dock with it.
Right.
So the idea is that there'll be a series of 11 missions over the next 2 years to finish building it. There'll be 2 more modules, 4 supply missions, and then 4 crewed missions. So there's currently 12 Chinese astronauts or taikonauts being trained to do these missions, which will be to assemble the space station, but also to then to start to do the work, because the idea is very similar to the ISS, that they will spend periods of up to 6 months at a time on the space station doing experiments.
I think I'm right in saying the Russians are also joining in with this.
I don't know if the Russians are joining in with the space station. I know that the Russians and the Chinese are doing a joint mission to the moon.
Right.
So they got linked together on that one. So it's there's different collaborations. So the Chinese have never been involved with a collaboration with the International Space Station because of the rules the Americans have about collaboration with the Chinese in anything.
All right. Let's move on to the night sky for the month. Paul, do you want to kick us off?
Well, yes, Pete. This is very much galaxy season, and the reason for that is that the direction that the night side of the Earth points is straight up out of the galaxy with Route 1 to space without being obscured by all the thick dust lanes in the plane of our galaxy. So when we look up, we see the constellation of Leo and Virgo and other smaller constellations like the Coma, Berenices constellation that you've probably never heard of. And they are full of galaxies. So we have the Virgo cluster of galaxies that contains that giant elliptical galaxy that had the black hole in the middle that they took the photograph of, and a whole chain of others in and around it called the Markarian chain that are very easy to pick up with a modest sized telescope. Then if you swing over to the Coma galaxy, you've got M64, Messier object number 64, the black eye galaxy, which really does look like someone's punched it in the face. And when you look at it, it definitely shows that sort of arched black eye across the top of it. Again, you'll need a modest sized telescope, perhaps an 8-inch reflector, maybe just about find it with a smaller 6-inch one for that. The Sunflower galaxy, the Crocodile eye galaxy, lots of interesting names. And all very different in their outlook. The Sunflower galaxy is very fluffy looking compared to the more starkly defined outlines of some of the others. And then you've got some globular clusters as well, which are nearer by. They are little micro galaxies, if you like, that orbit around the outside of the Milky Way. So there's M3 and M53, both in this same region of the sky. So there's lots and lots of deep sky objects to go and look for. And if you really want a challenge and you've got a powerful telescope, you can try and track down the Coma supercluster. It's called Abel 1656 and contains the brightest of its galaxies. It's about magnitude 13, so quite hard to find, NGC 4889. And that contains the largest black hole of any that we've ever discovered. It's 21 billion times the mass of the sun. Absolutely monstrous. Gosh. And the Coma supercluster contains about 10,000 galaxies. So you can really go galaxy surfing if you've got a very powerful telescope.
Indeed.
But if you've got binoculars, well, then you've got the Beehive Cluster next door in Cancer. It's a good place to start. You've got MELOT 111, which is in Coma, which is a very large open cluster with hundreds of bright stars in it. That's about 5 degrees across. So you can even see that nicely with the naked eye, but binoculars show it up superbly. And if you want an interesting star to pick out, then Core Corollae, Charles's Heart, is a very bright star with a really sort of red claret colour. And that's in the constellation of Canis Venatici, the hunting dogs.
Right.
Also in this part of the sky. So there's a lot of interesting objects to go and look at.
Certainly. Jonathan, what are you looking out for this month?
Well, I say it is deep sky because of the the reasons that Paul's described already. And we've already gone to galaxies and to globular clusters, so we've gone long distance and then galaxy clusters even further out. Nearer to home, you've got things called planetary nebulae, which are actually not planets. They are stars which have died and have blown off their outer layers to create a circular object in the sky, which is why the early astronomers assumed it was a planet, because it was circular. And two which people might have heard of are the Ring Nebula and the Dumbbell Nebula. Both are quite small, so they're not as easy to see as some other things. But the Ring Nebula is in the constellation of Lyra, the Harp, and it's actually directly between the two stars make up the base of it. So it's relatively easy to find if you can get to Lyra. And Lyra is actually quite low, close to the horizon now, so it's moving around. But anyway, it's the third sort of object you can look at. But then closer to home, we've got the Moon, of course. Last month, you may remember, we talked about there being a supermoon. Well, you wait a long time for a supermoon, and then, of course, two come along at once. And this month, we have another supermoon. And what supermoon means is the moon is at one of its closest points in its orbit to the Earth. So it appears a little bit bigger. Mm. And this month's supermoon is 100 kilometres closer than last month's supermoon. So it's actually just that tiny bit bigger. And the full moon will be on the 26th of May. One thing that's worth looking for, rather than the full moon, is actually a nice thin crescent moon. I've been listening to a podcast about these things. They keep calling it a toenail moon, which it seems a bit sort of, strange. But on the 13th of May, if it's a clear night, you'll have this very thin toenail moon with also Mercury, Venus and Mars in more or less a straight line. Mars is going to be very high up in the sky, but Mercury and Venus will actually be quite close to the thin crescent moon as well. So that might be quite a nice thing to have a look at. And of course, I have to mention, of course, that the Native American name for this month's moon is the Flower Moon.
Ah, right.
Because this is the time of year when all the flowers come out. It's as simple as that. So I
won't
carry on.
You need to write a thesis on this, Jonathan, or maybe you have already.
Oh no, it's all down for the almanac, which I keep referring to. There are other names for this moon. It could be the budding moon, the leaf budding moon, the egg laying moon, or the frog moon. There's loads and loads of different moons, so it carries on. Also closer to home, I mentioned Mercury and Venus just now. This is one of the times when we can actually get a view of Mercury. If it's a clear sky as the sun goes down, obviously be very, very careful. You'll be looking fairly close to the sun, so make sure the sun has set before you start pointing anything anywhere near it. But I think May 17th, Mercury will be at its highest point, which means it's furthest away from the sun. But if you just think about the geometry, at that point, we'll only be able to see half of it, because half of it will be lit up by the sun and the other half will be dark. It'll be like a half Mercury, like a half moon. Okay. So it'll actually be brighter before that point. So from the beginning of the month through to the middle of the month, May 17th, you've got a chance of seeing Mercury in the sky after the sun's gone down, in the general direction of where the sun has gone down. You'll also see Venus. Now, Venus is brighter. Venus might actually also be lower initially. So you can actually identify Venus and then look for another dot of light fairly near it, but slightly higher up. And that will probably be Mercury. And it's quite a rewarding thing to have said you found it, because not many people have seen Mercury. No. It's worth a go. So they're the two major objects in the evening sky. Mars is getting dimmer, but it's still there. And Jupiter and Saturn are visible, and they're getting higher in the early morning sky. So if you happen to be a night bird and get up before the sun does, you may well see Jupiter and Saturn. And Jupiter is the very brightest of the two. They are also quite close together, and they're good things to watch out for.
What about meteors, Paul? Anything for us to see meteor-wise?
Well, it's always very difficult at this time of year because we're starting to not really have very dark skies.
No.
And so unless you get particularly bright fireball meteors, as we would call them, then you tend not to see very many. I did see a particularly bright fireball in April for the Lyrid meteors on the 22nd, but I'm not expecting this month to really be any good. The next decent meteor shower is going to be in August, in fact, with the Perseids then. So I tend to find that we in May and June, it's just not dark enough.
Right, okay.
And so if you do happen to be up very late tonight, May the 4th until May the 5th, we are actually going through the tail of Halley's Comet. So if it's clear, and with all of the caveats Paul's put on it, you probably won't see anything at all. But
I've never seen them at this time.
They're called the Eta Aquarid meteor shower.
Right.
The radiance in Aquarius.
Yeah. We've nearly got to go through another break, so I want to talk about your double quasar topic, Paul, but we'll do that straight after the break, if we may. And then we'll also talk about the death of one of the Apollo 11 astronauts. There's now only one left, I'm afraid, because Michael Collins, who was the commander of the command module, and Apollo 11, he has recently passed away just about a week ago. So we'll have a little chat about him and all our local What's On as well. And also, if we've got some time, something about what I understand are moon trees.
The Night Sky in Focus and the latest news from space. This is The Sky Tonight with Pete Singleton and Cambridge astronomers Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough. Only on HCR 104 FM.
Welcome back to The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM. Right, straight into you, Paul. You've got something to tell us about a double quasar which has been spotted.
Yes, this is an item that was spotted from the very, very early universe. So this is an event that was occurring 10 billion years ago, and for which the light has only just reached us. So we're talking about two-thirds or more of the age of the universe and a very great distance that the light has had to travel to reach us. And really, it's the story of a galaxy collision. The galaxies form and grow by cannibalistic colliding together. They collide and merge, smaller galaxies turn into larger ones. But every galaxy has in its heart, right in the center, a supermassive black hole. And when the galaxies merge together, the black holes end up merging with each other, we think. And this particular observation, we think we finally caught one in the act, where we've detected the two active galactic nuclei, the quasars, where there are the supermassive black holes are feeding voraciously on lots of infalling gas and dust and the odd star. And growing fantastically quickly. And the two of them are spiraling in towards each other, towards a collision. They're about 10,000 light years apart only at the moment, and will soon spiral in, and in 100,000 years time or so, they will collide with each other and merge. But all of the disruption of them whirling around each other as they do this death spiral stirs up the material in the galaxy and causes them to acquire yet more material falling in towards them, which gets super hot in the accretion disk as it's spiraling in on its course to be devoured by the black hole. And black holes are thus very messy eaters because of all this hot gas swirling around them. Some of it gets shot out again in huge jets along the spin axis. And those spin axes of the two of them whirling around each other like that tends to sweep the galaxy clear of all of the remaining gas and dust and blow anything that isn't falling into the black hole well out of the galaxy. And so after the quasars then settle down, it tends to mean that the galaxy is no longer able to form new stars. It switches star formation off.
Okay.
And you end up with one of these giant elliptical galaxies with essentially an inactive core at the end of it, but it's very spectacular in the meantime. And we've had theories of, that this might be the case, but finally caught one in this sort of lucky moment in time where the two galaxies have started to merge, but the black holes have not yet collided with each other. So it's very much the missing link of galaxy formation.
Okay, then, thanks for that. Now, a lot of the astronauts from the Apollo era are sadly no longer with us, or they are very, very old men. I know we still have Charles Duke, we still have James Lovell, but we've recently learnt of the death of Michael Collins. Now, of course, he was the command module pilot on Apollo 11, the first mission to land men on the moon. So it's quite a significant thing to have happened, Jonathan. He's certainly a man who is, some have called, the forgotten astronaut of Apollo 11, but really amongst those that know about these things, he's hardly forgotten, because without him, of course, the two men on the moon would not have been coming home.
No, that's quite right. And I think stories you've read about him say that he was actually comfortable with his role.
Yeah.
And it was a very responsible role to have, because he had to ensure that he was on station for the LEM to come and re-dock with when the astronauts came back from the moon. There's a photograph, actually, which he took as the lunar module was coming up towards the command module. And it's noted as being the photograph which has got every member of mankind in it, because you can see the lunar module coming towards him, and you can see the Earth in the background over the horizon of the moon. So a very notable photograph. Of course, the only person who wasn't in the photo was him, the one person who wasn't there.
And he was.
No, it's very sad that he's passed, but he was 90 years old, so lived a good old age.
I think he was one of the few people. Well, he wasn't on Earth. I'm going to say the few people on Earth. He wasn't on Earth who did not actually see the moon landing itself, because of course he couldn't see it.
Well, yes.
So that's a sad occasion, but a life well lived. He was a military man, of course, as I understand it, as a lot of the astronauts of that era were. Mm. It'll be missed. And we just have now from that mission, Buzz Aldrin, Edwin R. Aldrin Jr., who's also in his 90s now and seems quite sprightly and still... Still doing the rounds there, so but he's the only one surviving from that mission. And as I've said before, a lot of the others are now sadly passed on, which is a shame, but that is the passage of time. Right, what's this about moon trees then?
Well, it actually works very well with this discussion about Michael Collins, because as an astronaut on Apollo 14, who was also the command module pilot, called Stu Roosa.
All right, yeah.
And so he didn't land on the moon, but he spent his time orbiting the moon, and he was on his own for longer because, of course, by then the missions were staying on the moon for rather longer. But he was equipped or took with him some seeds. He had about 500 seeds of different trees, which were orbited around the moon with him and then brought back to Earth. And much to my, unlike some of the organisation, we're talking about the SpaceX organisation earlier in the programme, they failed to keep track of where all these seeds went. They also had a bit of a jumble when they got back to Earth because the seeds managed to get all jumbled together, so they weren't sure which seed was for which sort of tree. But they planted a lot of these things, and much to their surprise, nearly all of them germinated, despite the fact that they hadn't been looked after as well as they'd hoped. They know where quite a lot of them are in the USA, and a lot of them are still alive. They believe 15 came to the UK, but they have no idea where they are. So the Royal Astronomical Society has currently launched a mission to try and find the moon trees. So right. If you're going around your local park and you look at labels on trees, if anything there says it's a moon tree, let the Royal Astronomical Society know. They'd be very keen to find out more about where these trees are.
So what sort of trees are they? It says,
It's a real mixture. There's sycamore, pine, a couple of different names which we know about. And if you go online and have a look at the website, there is actually a NASA website listing the ones they have in the USA. And I think there's ash as well. So it's quite a few well-known tree types. But we've tried the Kew Gardens, we've tried Jodrell Bangor Arboretum, and they have no records of the seeds that came to the UK. So it's a real Sherlock Holmes mission to try and find these things.
If anybody knows any information,
yeah,
answer it on a postcard, please, or an email.
That's right. There is one second generation moon tree, so a cutting from a moon tree, and that's actually at Flamsteed in the Chiltern Hills. And the Royal Astronomical Society are going to get a cutting from that, apparently.
Wow.
But other than that, we're not aware of any in the UK, but we think there could be up to 15 of the original trees here somewhere.
Gosh, that's interesting. Yeah. Right. Do we look now at what's on, particularly with your association, gents? Paul, I think you have some information on what's coming up. Perhaps anything else from any of the other neighbouring associations?
Yes, well, the Cambridge Astronomical Association is very pleased that on the 21st, we have Dr. Robert Smith, who is going to talk to us. This will be an event on Zoom, of course, at the moment, given the circumstances. And he is going to be talking about how far away are the stars, and how do we measure them, and how do we know. And then on the 29th, we've got the Cambridge Young Astronomers, 7 to 11-year-olds, again on Zoom, Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. So if any young budding scientists or astronomers are out there, do come and join us. You don't have to be a member at the moment, and you can just log in. The details are all on the website, and we should be talking about eclipses. And that's on the 29th, on the Saturday. I looked around the other local astronomical associations, and the only one I could find who was doing anything similar was the Ely Astronomy Club. And they have Dr. Natalie Starkey talking about ancient stardust and comets. And that's on the 14th of May, again, via Zoom. The other clubs are either just doing observing sessions or nothing at all at the moment, given the epidemic. So really, it's the Cambridge Astronomical Association, or ELE, are the only ones that I could find.
Okay. Paul, when do you envisage that physical meetings will begin to take place again?
For the Cambridge group, I think it's going to be probably around about October. And that's going to be because the university will have to decide whether or not across the whole of its fleet of buildings they're letting people use them or not, and that will be dependent on vaccination programs and policymakers needing to get together and make their mind up. So the start of the Michaelmas term, I should think, will be the date rather than any sooner.
Yeah. I mean, the Zoom meetings are very good, but it's nice to be able to all meet up and chat face-to-face rather than electronically, isn't it?
It will be, and it's been interesting doing it for just over a year now. We're doing it all via Zoom, and the feedback that we've had has been not only that, you know, thank you for doing it and it's great and to carry on doing something, but we had one or two of our very elderly members who said that it was great that we were doing it online because they could no longer physically get to the meetings.
Right.
So actually, there's a dilemma as to whether we should try to carry on not only doing them in person, but also somehow simultaneously casting them to the web so that those from further afield who can't make it, don't like driving in the dark, etc., can actually still join in.
Absolutely. And, the case for both, isn't there, really?
Yes. If you turn up, you'll get tea and biscuits. If you stay at home, you have to provide your own. So.
All right. I thought just very, very quickly, let's just talk very quickly. Jonathan, the plans for the moon seem to be getting closer and closer. NASA have awarded SpaceX a contract, haven't they, to have a lander on the moon?
Yes, they have. The Starship, which we talk about most weeks about its rapid unscheduled disassembly events. But Starship has been awarded the contract, or SpaceX has been awarded the contract, that Starship will be the moon lander for the Artemis program. And it's the only contract awarded. So they were originally going to have at least two to make it more competitive. But because budgets have been cut, they can only afford a relatively budget approach. And the work that SpaceX has been doing with reusability is paying off. Having said that, the contract they've been given is a $2.9 billion contract. So it's not exactly a budget, but that's the plan. So that means that it would appear that SpaceX are therefore getting a bit more cooperation from the local authorities in their testing of Starship. They've just been given clearance for their next three Starship test flights.
Yeah.
So rather than doing it one by one, they've been given clearance for three. And SN15, which is the next one, is ready on the launch pad. It's done some static fire tests. It hasn't yet flown, as far as I know, but it probably will fly fairly soon. And they will carry on. I think Starship's SN16, 17 are also built and ready to go. And the plan for Artemis overall was to put astronauts back on the moon by 2024. I think that's looking very optimistic now. But the Artemis booster, the space launch system, has now successfully passed its booster tests. It uses actually old space shuttle engines. And the booster launch has been, or the booster rocket has been transported to Kennedy, and is currently being put together with the rest of the equipment, ready for a potential launch later this year of an unmanned mission, but the first mission to test the whole system together.
Good. I just mentioned at this point, listeners, that whilst we do the recordings via Zoom, the program goes out on Tuesday, the 4th of May. And I'm looking at Paul Fellows, whose background is the Aurora Borealis. I notice on Jonathan's background, there's a space station just above your right shoulder.
Yep.
And if you look on mine, there's a space shuttle.
Yep.
So there we go. Thanks, gentlemen. It's been another full and interesting programme, so thank you for that. You've been listening to The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM, presented by me, Pete Singleton, with input and research from Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough of the Cambridge Astronomical Association. Coming up at 10, it's The Late Show with Tony Obi, and following the news and local weather at 8, it's Rock and Roll with John Rea. From all of us in this particular part of the universe, from Jonathan, good night, Jonathan.
Cheerio, Pete.
From Paul.
Good night, everyone.
And from me, until next time, on the 1st of June, our next show, we wish you a very and peaceful good night.